patient today is basically how did the church get here?
Because it's a long leap from the Mediterranean and the Balkans and Eastern Europe to Alaska.
And of course we know that the Russians came, but there's even some question as exactly who these Russian-speaking citizens of the Russian Empire were. We don't really know very much, as with the case of the ancient church. The first 5 years is what we can get from the scriptures, and a lot of detail is missing. The same is true for the first 50 years of Alaska history. If we define history as the story as it gets written down, then Alaska history starts in 1741. But for the first 50 years, we have very little records, and none of them in English. Because logically, if it were Russians who came, then the records are in Russian. And more than that, they're in Russia. So during the Cold War, it was virtually impossible to do any research into the initial 50 years of the Russian period. It doesn't mean we don't have any books about it. But, I put these names up here. Bancroft, Petrov, Chirikov, Bering, Brezhnev. I suppose that most people in the room will recognize only one name on that list. That's Bering, because there's a Z name for him, and people know that he came to Alaska first. Actually, Chirikov beat him by one day. Alexei Chirikov was here earlier, but he doesn't get any credit. You see, what I've learned studying the history of Alaska is this. History always has a point of view. There is no neutral history. When you write a book, there's no problem finding material, unless it's about this period of Alaska history, in which case all the material is someplace in Russia. But usually, if you wanted to write a history of the state of Alaska, technically that would be anything that ever happened in Alaska. More specifically, anything that ever happened in Alaska that someone wrote about. Because if you can't footnote it, you can't use it. So if it's something in writing, well, there's lots in writing. Every newspaper of every issue of every newspaper that ever has been published is Alaskan history. Obviously, you can't put everything that ever happened that's been written or published into one book. The historian's problem is not what to include. The historian's problem is what to leave out. And that's a value judgment. Because you have to decide what's important and what's not important. The evangelists had to make the same decision. St. John says, I haven't possibly begun to tell you everything that Jesus said and did. The world itself could not contain the books. But these things are written that you might believe and in faith have life. So it's the scripture itself says this is not an exhaustive biographical study of the God-man Jesus Christ, Emmanuel. It's not. There's no pretext to be. Well, it's the same thing. A publisher will say, you can't put that much into your book. We're limiting you to 250 pages. You have to tell the 250 years of Alaskan history. Approximately, you get allocated one page per year. A 250-page book is long enough. No one will read anything longer than that. Well, so you can't put all the memoirs of everybody who ever lived here, because that would fill this room. You have to choose, and the choice is made on the basis of what you consider to be important and what you consider not to be important. Pick up any history of Alaska, and many of you have been subjected to a course called the History of Alaska at the college or possibly grade school level. I can tell you without looking, without opening any text that we've got, the format of such a book. It starts with geography, just in case you don't know where Alaska is. It tells you where the rivers and the mountains and the glaciers and the seas are. Second chapter, the native people. We cover all these people who have been here for thousands of years, approximately in 20 pages. We give one page allotment to each. And they're grouped as Indians, Northwest Coast, Eskimos, and Aleuts. That's it, four groups, 20 pages. We get that out of the way. They're always in the past tense. It's as if they no longer exist. Then the third chapter is exploration and the Russians. We give that about 30 pages. The Russian period of Alaska history lasted 127 years, but we give it 20 to 30 pages out of the 250. It doesn't quite get 10%, although if it were balanced, it would be half. But we're missing the first 50 years because almost no one knows anything about that. And so the second two-thirds of the Russian period, from 1791, the founding of Kodiak, to 1867, the sale, that occupies our attention. And even not, if you look closely, not even that entire period. The only period that we know a lot about, or think we do, is the Baranov year, 1791 to 1818, when Alexander Baranov was governor of Alaska. We name things for this guy. The biggest hotel in Juneau is the Baranov, as they call it. It's Baranov in Russian, but we say Baranov because we have to mispronounce usually what we get from other countries. Then there's Baranov Island. Sitka stands on a whole island named for this guy. And here and there are different streets and other things named for Alexander Baranov. Well, Mr. Baranov, will come to him in this lecture, is no hero of mine, and you'll come to understand why in a few minutes. Why we know so much about Mr. Baranov is his best friend and private secretary, Kirill Klebnikov, wrote a book about Baranov, which was available to the first American historian who wrote the history of Alaska. So the Baranov years, 1791 to 1818, it's 27 years out of 127 years, are almost the exclusive focus of our Russian chapter, the one chapter that the Russian period gets in our histories of Alaska. And it's not because people like Baranov or knew that much about him, it was because the archives were available. There weren't papers, diaries, reports, and letters available from the first 50 years, so that's kind of murky. The next 100 or so years, well, 91 to 67, so it's 74 years to be exact, those years are pretty much neglected too, except for the career of Alexander Baranov, because Hubert H. Bancroft, who wrote the history of Alaska in San Francisco without leaving home, in the 1880s, had the Klebnikov biography of Baranov at his disposal. It was published already. It was like 70 years after Baranov had died, and it was published in Russian, and it was available to him and to his translator, Ivan Petrov. Petrov was hired to translate the book into English so Bancroft could incorporate all those things into his history of Alaska, which is about 400 pages. It's a very substantial book. But please notice, Mr. Hubert Bancroft had a problem writing a history of Alaska, which at that time was 1741 to 1870. He took that 130-year period or so and wrote a history of Alaska, quite substantial, without knowing Russian, when every document he needed to write such a history was in the Russian language. So, of course, he needed Mr. Petrov to translate for him the limited number of archives that he had. Now, I said that all histories have a point of view. Mr. Klebnikov, I already told you, was Baranov's personal secretary and best friend. You can guess what point of view he has on his hero, Alexander Baranov, as he wrote that almost hero-worshipping volume about Baranov. So Klebnikov's attitude toward Baranov is very positive. He denigrates all Baranov's opponents, foes, and critics, and he makes Baranov a great hero. This has tremendous social implications even for us today. For 30 years in Kodiak, anyone who'd been to Kodiak, say, from the mid-50s to the mid-80s knows that the whole town got behind the staging of an interminably long, and in my opinion, boring, pageant called The Cry of the Wild Ram. There's even an amphitheater built just for the performance of this amphitheater, this outdoor pageant. Baran is Ram. This is nothing more than Klebnikov's biography of Baranov, translated by Petrov, inserted into Bancroft's history, and now dramatized for all Alaska to see. And all of Baranov's opponents and critics are denigrated or brushed aside, because this is the product of Klebnikov's point of view on his friend and hero, Alexander Baranov, the Russian governor, from 1791 to 1818. So people by the thousands are exposed to what amounts to this pro-Baranov propaganda, which comes straight from Klebnikov's pen and is translated by Petrov and Bancroft for American readers over 100 years ago. Now, the problem with Bancroft's history was not only that he only had basically one or two books at his disposal, but that he had Petrov as his translator, because Petrov didn't like Bancroft. And Petrov was also second characteristic, besides not liking Bancroft. I don't like Bancroft much myself, but Petrov also was lazy. And thirdly, Petrov was very imaginative. You put these together and what you wind up with is the history of Alaska from the fertile imagination of Mr. Petrov. He didn't bother even to translate a lot of the material he actually had. He made it up. Entire chapters of the Bancroft history are nothing more than the product of Mr. Petrov's fantasies. Bancroft couldn't check. He didn't know Russian. Entire documents. He presented the English translation of documents that never existed in Russian in the first place. Including, and we'll come to this tomorrow, the diary of St. Juvenali. Petrov claims to have somehow, it's a very ingenious scheme, have come across the personal diary of Hiram Monk Juvenali, even his dying words, because it ends in mid-sentence, and translated it from the original Russian into English, and then presents it to Bancroft. It becomes a chapter in the book. Hector Chevenier in the 1970s took Bancroft's rather dull and boring, dry as dust history and livened it. Chevenier was not an historian, but he was a dramatist. So he took the old histories and made them exciting, made them lively. I remember reading Hector Chevenier's books when I first came to Alaska because they were, Bancroft was not accessible, out of print. You had to dig it out of a library someplace and you wouldn't pick up something thicker than War and Peace anyway. Hector Chevenier took Bancroft and broke it up into like five or six miniseries, you know, and they're all exciting. Lord of Alaska, the story of Nikolai Rezanov, Lost Frontier, then there was Russian America, which was subtitled The Russian American Adventure. And generations of Alaskans read these books because they were far more accessible and way more entertaining than the Bancroft original. But it was just Bancroft rehashed. No new information, because the people doing this were not historians and they weren't going into Russia to archives, digging through the file cabinets and finding new information about anything in Alaska history. They were just taking the old 100-year-old Bancroft and dusting him up off a bit with a new shine, a new paint job, and it becomes the history of Alaska again. Virtually all the histories of Alaska are nothing more than Bancroft rewritten in one form or another. No one has ever gone back to find out how much of it is fiction based on Petrov, although Petrov was sued about this in the 1890s. They found out he had made up whole bits and pieces. And he admits in court he fabricated entire chapters of the book. But later historians still don't question Bancroft. He was a very reputable American historian. He wrote the history of Mexico. He wrote the history of the American West. The Bancroft Library at Berkeley is named for him. He was a very famous and prominent American historian, but he really messed up the history of Alaska. And that wasn't all his fault, although, you know, learning Russian might have been part of the project. But he didn't have the Russian archives at his disposal, and he had this shyster, Mr. Petrov, as his only informant, who then had a free hand in making it all up. So what's in the books when it comes to the history of Alaska is radically different from the oral tradition among the native people. Radically different. So I came to Alaska 27 years ago. I was living on Kodiak Island. I read all these pro-Baranov hero, carving a civilization out of the wilderness kind of one-man colony guy. I heard all these things. I read all these things in the books because I was interested in the history of the state. And discussing this with Native Alaskans, many of whom hadn't gone to high school, they'd say, well, it ain't the way we heard it from our grandparents or our great-grandparents. And I'd say, yeah, well, Granny says one thing, the books say something else, but I'll stick with the book. That's part of our culture. It's where we started last night. If it's in writing, for us, it's real. It has authority. And we'd go by the books, we go by the texts. It doesn't occur to us that the books could be wrong. And besides, who is this grandmother to know history better than these authorities, famous professors from universities in such places as California? You know, there's no comparison, right? Little by little, however, I came to believe that the oral tradition, so unanimous among the native people, must have some validity. And I had the opportunity, I had access to some Russian archives from the Library of Congress. In 1978, I began sending away for microfilms. They'd print them out like on a fax machine. It would come out white letters on black backgrounds. But if you paid 10 cents a sheet, you could get as many of these kind of things as possible. It turns out that during the Depression, during the Depression in the United States, they had a WPA project for PhDs. It wasn't just for people out on, in the wilderness, in forests, or on farms. They hired scholars, and some Russian scholars were actually hired to go through some of the archives left behind, or of which we had copies, in Washington, D.C., and there were volumes of this, again, untouched by Alaskan historians. So this made a lot of things way more accessible than before, because it was already in English. And then there were other things that were still in Russian, but at least you had a clue where to find them. So I take a story, something that a Native Alaskan grandmother had told me about this era, that they'd been told by their grandmother, that they'd been told by their grandmother. But by the way, that's as far as it has to go. A grandmother nowadays, born at the turn of the century, has a grandmother born in 1830, who has a grandmother born in the 1700s. So you're not as far removed as you think. We think a couple hundred years, wow, it's whispered down the alley. By the time it came to this person, it's really been garbled. They've only gone through two informants. My grandmother's grandmother told her, and my grandmother told me. That's it. You're that close to the original events. This is something to keep in mind in biblical history. We think, Justin the Martyr, second century, it's so long after Christ, but it's possible for such a person to know an elder who knew an apostle. You're still that close to the original story and to eyewitness accounts. And not only to the eyewitness accounts or the pieces that we have in the scriptures, but to others, to other information. And you're dealing with people who knew, who saw with their eyes and heard with their ears and touched with their hands. It's that close, just two informants away. So once you realize that, you say, well, maybe Grandma does know what she's talking about. And I check to find if there was a Russian version of the same incident. Much to my amazement, every time I've done that, Granny has always been right and Bancroft has always been wrong. I have not yet found a case where the oral tradition isn't in fact corroborated by the authentic archives, which, don't forget, our historian never saw. And even if he had them, I doubt if Petrov would have bothered to read them. He would have made up something more interesting. So we have a frontier here in talking about the history of Alaska. Now, even in the 20 or 30 pages that we get in our textbooks, the Russian period is reduced, to that short a time, a space, 10% of the book. We skip over the first era, which I have to talk about at length in a little while, only by saying that Rambo style, the Russians, apparently as a military conquest, rushed into Alaska, their guns blazing, raped and pillaged, murdered and killed, took all the furs they could back to Russia, and then when they were done doing that, they sold Alaska to the United States. There's the Russian era, 127 years in a nutshell. Except for Baranov, who tried, as best he could, Wyatt Earp style, to curb the violence and bring law and order and civilization to the frontier. If anyone has studied Alaska history and even read any book of the history of this state at all, that is the Russian period in a nutshell. No mention of the missionaries. No mention of St. Herman, or if there is a mention of, there might be a sentence or possibly two about St. Innocent, somewhat begrudgingly to say, but they weren't all bad. There was this one good guy. But it's not much to show for 127 years, half the history of the state, and out of all the Russians they can mention, there was one guy we have to somewhat reluctantly admit wasn't as bad as the others. That's the best we could do. Now, there's several other factors militating against a re-examination of the Russian period of Alaska's history. Besides the fact that the archives are still in Russia, for the most part, and have not been explored by Russian or Soviet historians yet either, there's the whole fact that we were involved at least for 50 years in a Cold War with the Soviet Union. You didn't want to say anything nice about the Ruskies. So, for our own purposes, the very negative view of the Russian period and of Russians in general in our history books suited our purposes. It fit with the stereotype of the Russians as always being nasty, violent, and brutal people who always treat everybody that way. It's not just Budapest 1956 or Prague 1968. It goes back to Attu 1742. You see, they've always been that way. It fits our stereotype of the good guys and the bad guys. It's a mythic structure. You have to have heroes and you have to have villains in any mythic or legendary saga, and that's what we have. So we have that working against us. Inaccessible to the archives, then, inaccessibility. A bogus history to start with, and then an unwillingness. There's something else I should mention, come to think of it. There is one rather famous Alaskan historian today, Dr. Klaus Naske, who has written The History of Alaska, the 49th State, Slotnick and Naske, but it's mostly Naske's work. Dr. Klaus Naske is of German descent. He speaks and reads and writes fluent Russian. He has never spent a minute looking at the Russian records or archives. He is simply not interested in anything Russian for very personal reasons. During the Second World War, he was taken prisoner by the Soviet Army. He wasn't well treated. And so if our histories say only negative things about Russians, it's fine with him. We can't even get, in other words, among our history department at our own university, an honest reassessment of this early period of Alaska's history, for all the reasons I've just cited. So it's an uphill battle, I must say, to get historians to reconsider what they think they already know, because the book says. And lastly, I'll tell you one experiment I run with my students when I teach Alaska history. It's a real booby trap of an assignment. I give them Bancroft. I give them Xerox chapters of Hubert Bancroft's book. Then I give them my research, but not on paper. I give them a talk like this with an audio cassette. And then I give them some archival materials that I've translated from Russian into English or that someone else has. And they have an assignment. Read the book, listen to the tapes, and if you so desire, it's optional, refer to the Xeroxed researched articles, translations. That comes third and it's optional. And then answer these questions. What I get from all my students, and it's so obvious, is simply what the book says. There's no evidence the first go around that they listen to the tapes at all. I can tell because you know how to do a history class. You've been doing it since the fourth grade. You don't even bother to read the assignment, right? You look at the questions first, you flip through the text to find the right answer, and you paraphrase that. Now, these are college seniors, but it doesn't matter. They still know how to do a history course, right? So I get chapter and verse paraphrased. They don't quote it exactly, but they put the put the second sentence first and they change the verbs and the adjectives. But you get pretty much right out of the book whatever the book said. It shows absolutely no stimulation of gray matter whatsoever. It took nothing to do this kind of assignment. And so they go through five or six questions and boom, 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 and they send it in and they get it back from me with an F on it. I underline on their assignment sheet, the assignment was read the text, which I'm not even sure they've done that, but and then listen to the audio cassettes, and I say to them, there is no evidence in your answer that you listened to my lecture on the tapes. Oops. So they claim the second time around to have listened to the audio cassettes, but their answer remains the same as the first time. They say, honest father, I listened to the tape, but this is the answer, that's what I'm going with. F. Redo. The third or fourth go around, finally, the student listens to the tape, actually listens to it, and ponders the book, which, by the way, contradict each other. If you really listened and take the oral tradition seriously, what people say, and this is, by the way, get a clue, it's the professor on the tape. If you take the tape seriously and the book and give them equal value, they cancel each other out perfectly. So that the right answer to question to the first unit of my course is, I don't know. I can't tell yet. You see, this is a breakthrough in history. Everyone thinks that history falls out of the sky. The text is there, that's it. And all you have to do is memorize it. Fundamentalism has the same problem. Who wrote this text? From what context does it come? Why should I believe this guy? You say, well, it's the Word of God. It's the Word of God expressed in human words, in human language. It's the same with the canons of the church, by the way. They all come out of a context. None of them can be understood outside that context. They didn't sit around in Nicaea or Chalcedon or any other council and say, look, what new rules should we dream up? They had problems that had to be addressed, and it was because of that problem they responded with this norm. Canon means norm. It's not a law. Under normal circumstances, under normal conditions, this is the way it's normally done. That's really what the church is saying when they issue a canon. Now, of course, you can have every justification to say, yes, but these are abnormal circumstances, or it's a totally different situation from which that canon arose. If that's the case, then obviously the canon doesn't apply. But you can't just pick up a book of, quote, canon law, which is a kind of redundancy, and say, this is the rule, that's how we have to apply it. This is a kind of fundamentalist approach to church life, right? The book says, they decreed this in the 14th or the 3rd or the 6th century, it doesn't matter, and that's it. Out of context, you don't even know what the rule was for. The same is true actually liturgically. People completely misunderstand even things about royal doors and doors. The rubrics could have been written at times when there were, when the royal doors met the doors of the church. Unless you know the context out of which the rubrics came, you can't always understand what they're supposed to mean and what's supposed to be done. How do you know? It's filled in by the life of the community. The little old grandmother does know, and the learned theologian might not. I've been to enough WCC conferences, World Council of Churches conferences, to know there are plenty of doctors of theology who have no faith. You see, they're not a member of the church, of the community, of a worshiping, praying congregation. For them, it's a job, and they're the expert, and they get paid for giving their opinions. Of course, that's not true of Orthodox theologians nearly so much, because most of the Orthodox, I don't remember ever meeting an Orthodox theologian who wasn't, in fact, a believer and sincerely Orthodox. But I have met men and women from various other faith traditions for whom that's irrelevant. I'm just quoting the text, and I know I have an educated guess that the original Aramaic that the Lord himself spoke, and the Greek, and how it's been modified, and you know, they have all these theories, and it's their ideas again. But they're a doctor of theology, and we have to take this seriously, and they've written 5 books on it. Yes, but I think my grandmother understood it better. You know, that's the conclusion I can come to. Because being a part of the living community gives you the context out of which to understand the text. And there's simply no substitute for that. There is no text that didn't come out of a context. Even our history of Alaska comes out of a context of 19th century American historiography, Hubert Bancroft, Petrov's machinations, and all the rest. Hector Chevenier's history comes out of a context of a dramatist who was bored with the Alaska history the way it was written and decided to jazz it up. But you have to know that about the book. Otherwise, you think that every word in it is gospel truth. You have to know that about the Gospels, from an Orthodox perspective at least, to understand them appropriately. As Professor Ketchers has been brilliantly doing for us for 2 days, we realize that you have to know why this letter was written and to whom and who they're implying by that sentence that we just read. Why is this an issue at all? And then in that context, you can understand what was meant by the epistle. But without the context, you can't understand the text. And that context includes the whole culture out of which it came. That's true for liturgics. It's true for patristics. The Holy Fathers didn't just sit around and say, I think I'll write a dissertation against Doceticism today. There had to be some docetics out there. You see, they didn't just dream up theological problems in an ivory tower in a cultural vacuum. They were responding to the needs of the community. They were responding to the issues of the day. Nowadays, we have people quoting the church fathers as if they were simply authorities like biblical texts to be applied to 21st century situations. First, understand the situation they were writing in, the whole context out of which those writings came, and then understand how it might apply to your unique situation or new situation now. In other words, what I'm saying here is, as Orthodox Christians, we are contextualists. We are committed to being contextual, to not understanding, focusing not only on the text itself, whether it's canonical text or liturgical text or biblical text or patristic text, but to understand the whole milieu that produced it and the circumstances out of which it arose. Contextualism is the opposite of fundamentalism. There are those in our church who want to say contextualists are modernists, and they are traditionalists. I object to these labels with every fiber of my being. I am not a modernist, I'm a contextualist. And I deny them the title of traditionalist, because that's claiming the high ground in a traditional church.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over for the continuation of the message on side two.